It was kind of question. If I can lose silver, we can get. Thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Man. Check back next week. Get it, Jim? We're starting at the end this time.
Oh, that's clever.
Isn't that so hacky? Maybe I'll even do that line, play that line in reverse just to fuck with people even more. No, welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex. With me, as usual, is James. Be sure to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We've talked about a lot of good movies recently. Last week we talked about Vertigo, Silence of the Lambs, I believe, was the week before that. Next week we'll be talking about Nightcrawler, and the following week we'll be talking about Interstellar, which is kind of related to today's topic. So yeah, follow us on Twitter at the MacGuffin Men, and let's just get right to it because James has places to be.
I don't even know how long she's been gone. It's like I've woken up in bed and she's not here. Because she's gone to the bathroom or something. But somehow I just know she's never gonna come back to bed. If I could just reach over and touch her side of the bed, I would know that it was cold. But I can't. I know I can't have her back. But I don't want to wake up in the morning thinking she's still here. I lie here not knowing how long I've been alone. So how can I heal? How am I supposed to heal if I can't feel time?
All right, James.
James or John.
But your mom calls you Teddy.
Right? This shares more of Vertigo than I thought it did.
know. I was having a bit of a laugh to that one because I always thought it was weird, but just never really thought about it and Vertigo so closely together. But
all right, well, for the benefit of the listener,
we don't do this for them.
Let's do some of this in chronological order.
Okay.
We are talking about the film Memento
correct
from 2000.
Yes.
The
It's kind of from 2000. It played festivals in 2000, but was released to people like us in 2001.
Okay, yeah, that's kind of what I got too, but it's officially listed as 2000, so.
Yes.
And am I saying this right? Directed by Christopher Nolan?
Yeah, just like people from New Orleans say New Orleans. That's how you
Right.
pronounce his last name.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
No, directed by Christopher Nolan. Now very famous Christopher Nolan, but at the time not nearly as much so.
Well, yeah, certainly when the film was released and that he sort of became the last of the indie wonder kid directors.
Right. And based on a short story written by his brother Jonathan Nolan, and yeah, Guy Pearce, Carrie-Anne Moss, Joe Pantoliano, right?
That's not how you pronounce his name, but
No, Joy Pants.
There you go. That's correct. Yes. I mean, anybody listening to this podcast knows the basic idea of this movie. Man's wife is murdered. Man is on vengeance quest. Story is told backwards. And movie is very good.
Yeah, like it does kind of have that that interesting concept. Like there's so many revenge movie, so many man's wife or child is taken from him and he seeks revenge. Yeah, just the two big distinguishing factors with this one is the memory loss and then the actual storytelling technique. So one of them is obviously a lot more just kind of on the page from the short story, and the manner in which it's told, I think, is another part of what makes this movie so interesting. But we kind of have two things. We have something kind of in the script, and then we have something in the actual cinematic storytelling of this that makes it much different than a pretty big subgenre of, wife revenge movie.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of it's that I don't know. It's that type of thing that was really popular around the time. Like The Sopranos is a good example, because The Sopranos really starts the quote unquote golden era of television that people like to talk about so much. But what The Sopranos did was use a tried and true formula of the mob story and just kind of change a couple little things about it to make it new and interesting. And that's what Memento does with a vengeance movie, and makes it new and interesting and phenomenally interesting, phenomenally entertaining. That's what I might say.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you see this when it came out, or?
Not in theaters. I saw it very soon after it came out on video.
Okay. And you liked it then?
Oh, fuck yes. I was like 15 at the time. It blew my goddamn mind. It was wonderful.
Yeah, I guess. And it was like then, do you remember it being known for the structure we were talking about, or the memory element or anything?
Oh yeah, I mean, pretty much that was the way the movie was talked about very early on. Like, I think the first time I actually heard about the movie was on like Much News, when they were doing a report on what is the most popular rentals of the time, and they showed the clip where he's getting chased by Dodd, and he's having that conversation like, oh, I'm chasing this guy, oh no, he's chasing me. And then they had to explain the conceit for that clip to make any sort of sense, and I was like, oh, this is a movie I will watch. I saw guns and I laughed, and there was,
I'm 15.
Yeah, exactly. I love beige suits.
No, that's really weird you say that though, because I remember that being kind of my first exposure to this film as well. Is that exact scene where
George Strombolopoulos on Much News?
I don't remember if it was that, but I just remember the clip and being in it, not being part of a like a commercial or a trailer, just some kind of other media outlet, and it very well could have been that, but I didn't realize it was a Much Music thing.
Yeah,
yeah, but that's so much the selling feature of this movie. It has a lot of good things going on in it, but that's kind of the really unique.
Yeah,
it really stand out along with the structure, like I said, and any Wikipedia page that has a diagram explaining the structure of the movie, like, you're watching something that you're gonna have to pay attention to a lot.
Yeah, but here the thing that I find most impressive about this movie, and I think you could say this about a lot of Nolan movies, is that it's just, you don't need to be following things 100% for it to be really enjoyable. Like, I know I didn't understand every single connecting thread in this movie the first time I saw it, because I was still piecing together new things today when I watched it again. But it didn't matter, because the things that really matter for you to follow the movie in some sort of way, in a way that is satisfying to you, Nolan always makes sure to hit those notes perfectly, or at least in the vast majority of his movies. Inception's another really good example of this, where he makes sure to nail the most important parts and make it sort of this satisfying movie to just sit and watch, but it also has this sort of mystifying element to it that makes you want to think about it again and maybe want to watch it again. But his movies are always satisfying on one viewing, but often become better with a second,
Yeah, and there's that when you say that, it reminds me of the scene when he's at Natalie's house and she is very abusive towards him and then leaves knowing he's going to forget it all and come back in.
Yeah.
Definitely not the first time I saw it. I still don't know like fully her whole plan and how she's like working him in and pulling the wool over his eyes, but it's just an entertaining scene because just enough that, okay, she's going to try to trick him. We know about his mental condition. We know she's not a good person, and it just plays itself out in a really entertaining way, and you don't need to know what plot point E is going to be, because watching A to B is, as you said, it's all on the screen there. It's still very fascinating just to watch that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the Natalie and Leonard relationship is always kind of weird. Like, she refers to them, like she says, we can still be best friends in that scene, even though they seem to have met like a day before. It's really weird, and she seems to come to the idea that, oh, I'm going to trick this man into killing people for me kind of quickly. Or at least attempt to do that kind of quickly. But, it doesn't hurt the movie, I don't think, because you spend a lot of time thinking before you get to thinking about the isolated Natalie plot, you know?
Yeah. Well, and it's like similar
this movie's 14 years old, and today is the first day I've thought about that. You know?
Yeah. Well, it is one of the similarities with Vertigo. People find someone with a mental condition and use him to get away with a crime. Yeah. Like it seems very, very complicated. But I think, as we kind of conclude with Vertigo, the movie just still stands up as a very entertaining watch once you get past those kinds of things.
So. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, so let's talk about the structure a bit, because that seems to be kind of central to the people's enjoyment of this movie, and mm-hmm. really what makes it unique for so many people.
Yeah.
And I mean, you mentioned Sopranos. We're not too far off from Quentin Tarantino really telling a story out of order and making a very fascinating auteur movie out of that technique.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, I found a quote from one of the producers of Memento. I think it was one of the Todd sisters, Suzanne or Jennifer, talking about Quentin Tarantino and how he just sort of plays with time but doesn't really seem to mean anything by it, whereas the playing with time in this film is kind of important to the meaning of the film. Now, I don't entirely agree with that quote, but I think it's, you know, at least 50% right. This movie, I think, does a lot more with its conceit because the structure of the film kind of allows you to sort of float in and out of these moments, these scenes, in a way that kind of makes them feel not connected, sort of independent, even though they do all connect. Just watching them all back to back, it kind of feels like this sequence, more than this one cohesive narrative, in a way that kind of enhances the feel of it being kind of being memories, you know? And it's all impossible, difficult to explain, but that's kind of the idea that I get from it. It's sort of this film where you don't always remember the order of things because they're so separated from each other, even though they all flow into each other eventually. There is this real jagged ending to so many moments in this movie, but it still somehow works together. And then it also further backs up the idea that Nolan and company want this to feel like a collection of memories, you know?
Oh, yeah. I literally can't think of another movie that telling, like, to play with the chronology of events is better used. Like, to put you in the shoes of the protagonist, that's what the structure of Memento is all about. And mm-hmm. it's so successful. And again, as someone who does not have this mental condition, I can't speak to, you know, how similar watching this movie is to having it, but you can definitely see what they're going for. And I think they nail it a lot of times. I was reading about some doctors who treat memory conditions, and this one in particular, and they said that there's a sense of perpetual presentness mm-hmm. in people who are afflicted with this, and that's what this movie is. Like, you're so often without context and just grasping for anything on screen to kind of piece together where you are in the story, where you are chronologically, what Lenny's up to, where this is taking place, you know, whose hotel room, if it's a hotel room. There's so many questions being asked of the viewer. It's so often throughout this movie that this lack of context and this constant confusion really, really lets you empathize with the main character of this movie. And I think, you know, there's not a better movie to have something that plays with chronology like this. Like, this is having a main character with this affliction is just so perfect for telling a story in this manner.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've seen, I don't really agree with that Quentin Tarantino quote fully, because there is, or that quote about Tarantino, because I think it does serve some purposes, but this just blows. Yeah. Like, it's so far from kind of what he does that there is just such a complete function of the mixed up storytelling that this is perfect for.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so we've got the black and white, you know, portion of this movie, I guess.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening in proper chronological logical order. Mm-hmm. And then all the color things are happening in reverse. Like we're seeing, you know, what is really the most recent event first and then working backwards.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought it was interesting, and it's kind of the first time I thought about it was watching it this time, is that all the stuff in color seems to be true, and all the black and white stuff, it's kind of up for debate. And we see some definite falsehoods in the black and white timeline.
Yeah, such as?
Well, very, very near the end of the film, we learn that Sammy Jenkins' case is not the way that Leonard has been telling it throughout the movie at all.
Yeah, for sure. But I think there are some, it's certainly up for debate, but I think there are some things that are in the black and white footage that are hard to debate. You know, like the, I do think he's talking to Teddy on the phone, for at least the last portion of the phone calls. But yes, I agree that there is certainly some stuff that is up for debate, you know.
Oh, you mean, not everything in black and white's a lie.
Yeah, yeah. No, I know. I'm saying the same thing.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's I just mean, like, thematically, that's interesting to me. Like, when we have this full range of color is when we get the truth. And when we try to break things down and make them simple and make them black and white, that's when we get deception. Mm-hmm. The world just isn't that simple. And you know, by the end of the movie, we kind of, at least one interpretation is we know what Leonard's doing. He's, you know, lying to himself for 30 seconds so he can have purpose in his life for a year. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, that idea of having these things black and white, having, you know, you're a good guy, the killers are bad guys, your wife was good, Teddy's bad. When we break these things into these false dichotomies is when we run into problems. And then when we have this colored narrative going forward, we have what seems to be reality, and it can be very ugly, but it seems to be the actual truth in this movie. And really, the colored parts of this movie, I think we have to believe all of, and the black and white parts of this movie, we can't believe all of, because they are, you know, they contradict themselves within that one timeline.
Yeah. So you would take a Polaroid of one of the black and white pieces of footage and write "Don't believe his lies" on the back of it.
I would. Yeah. What do you think of that opening shot with the Polaroid?
That's fucking awesome.
Okay. What's awesome
about it? It's such a great way to pull you into the movie, because specifically the first shot, it's kind of a longer shot. And the hand is very still. We don't necessarily know that things are moving in reverse for a while. And it seems like a pretty standard credit sequence of seeing these names pop up while this Polaroid develops. What is this Polaroid of? Well, it backwards develops, I suppose. And we may or may not clue into it while it's happening. And then you see shots of what was going on around. You see Teddy's corpse. You see the glasses on the ground, the shell casing, and they're all static. And then you see the blood sort of coming up the wall. Then you see the shell casing going back into the gun. And then the first shot where things really are very obviously moving in reverse is the one where Leonard throws down the gun, because the gun pops back up into his hand. Yeah. And at that moment, like, you have to know that things are going in reverse, you know.
Or he has a much different power.
yeah, that's true. But yeah, I think it's this really, really interesting off-kilter way to start the movie, and a very visually engaging way to say, hey, this is a movie that you should pay attention to, because some things are going to be subtle, some things are going to be obvious, but everything matters, you know?
Yeah, no, it's they don't really spoon feed you things in this movie. And I think it goes, it speaks to the point you made earlier about Christopher Nolan movies, where things on screen are usually pretty engaging. And I think about that shot, and, you know, every time you've seen a Polaroid changing, it's going from that solid gray to whatever you just took a picture of. Mm-hmm. And it's happening so gradually that you're watching and you're not sure if it's developing or reverse developing or whatever. And yeah, it's just you really, I don't know. I find you just get really pulled in trying to figure out, like, what's happening in this picture? What's even in this picture? Yeah. And it's this quiet moment, and you just pay a lot of attention to it. And then, as you said, you know, we see guns and blood. And
then Joey, you know, Joey Pants, RIP.
Yeah. But, I mean, you see these bigger things that you know, point to a much bigger story, but it first got you involved in the story with something small, something visual, something just a bit off kilter, and then you get hooked, and then, okay, now I'm in the middle of a crime scene. Who's the body? Who's the killer? What's going on here? And by that time, like, I find you're just fully sucked into this movie.
Yeah, exactly. And another thing that makes that sequence really great is that despite the footage going in reverse, the sound is going forward. And one, I think that's a cool decision because, I mean, since we don't recognize any sounds backwards, you know, because everything, since nobody listens to things in reverse that frequently, everything in reverse kind of sounds the same to, you know, more or less.
Yeah.
And that sort of the first time you get like this noticeable sound that you may or may not notice is odd or wrong, but is when he shakes the Polaroid in that first close-up of his hand. You hear the sound of somebody shaking a Polaroid, but he's kind of shaking it oddly. And whether or not you clue into the fact that this thing is going in reverse by then, it still creates this weird off-putting sort of separation, you know? And I think it kind of helps in this very tiny, subtle way, set up the two ways the story is told throughout this movie. How, you know, we've got the black and white footage and the color footage, and they will eventually meet in the middle, you know?
Yeah, and even just the idea of the sound of any audio noise pretty much in reverse. Like, you have kind of the collision, whatever's making your sound, and then it kind of fades out. And then in reverse, we have it kind of fading into this big point. And that's, you know, kind of the way this story is told. We have these two things that seem separate, you know, kind of traveling different directions. And then they all kind of meet up at that one moment where the black and white turns to color, or color turns to black and white. I forget which one it is, but it all just really coalesces to this one moment, which would be that initial thing that made that sound.
Yeah. Black and white turns to color, by the way.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
And one more thing about the photograph thematically, like you know, I discussed why visually and audio wise that sequence, you know, kind of ropes you in. But watching it again, I've seen this movie a few times, so I knew the ending and or the beginning. but knowing that, I was thinking about him shaking this Polaroid picture, and it's he's putting in work to, like, when you watch it in reverse, when you watch it from having this picture, you know, this clear picture, to getting this gray, you know, blurred mess that a Polaroid photo is before it develops.
Yeah.
We see him deceiving himself. We see him, he has the answer in his hand, he has the truth. And he's putting in work to reject that truth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, by the end of the movie, we see that he doesn't really want to finish this quest of his. He kind of feels purpose doing this forever, it seems.
Yeah.
That to him, it's not really about getting that guy who killed him, who did this to him and his wife. It's about, you know, feeling value and feeling importance. And I think his way of doing that is to reject information and to purposely deceive himself. And so to see him kind of reverse shake that thing, it's like an Etch-a-Sketch. Like, you have something, you can read it, you can see what it really is. But Leonard throughout this movie is actively rejecting information so he can stay in this kind of blissful, it's not quite ignorance, but blissful deception.
Yeah.
And for them to do that so quickly in the movie, to, you know, to get you engaged, to kind of place you in the story, and to tell something thematically that you can't even get until you've seen the movie to the end and you're rewatching the movie, I think is just, like, I don't know what more you could ask for in an opening.
Yeah, no, exactly. And this is something that, again, throughout Nolan's career, he has this sort of very utilitarian, very natural, realistic filmmaking style generally. And the only movie that features a lot of visual storytelling, and by a lot, I mean a lot for Nolan, is The Dark Knight. Whereas most of his movies, he has these little bits of visual storytelling in them, like, say, the last shot of Inception, or The Dark Knight Rises when Bruce Wayne's climbing out of the prison, where he just does this little bit of visual storytelling that he really wants you to focus in on. And that's the opening of this movie. And he's so creative when he wants to do these things. It's just very frequently he doesn't want to slow down the momentum of the film production, sort of add these things in constantly. And it sort of, it elevates the moments where you do choose to tell these things so visually, and it sort of allows the viewer, like you just did, since it's one of, I mean, it's the most stylistic moment of this movie outside of the narrative. So it's the thing that you can focus on the most. And so you put more thought into it just because there are no other scenes like that. There's just a lot of basic handheld camera work otherwise. And yeah, this is something that, again, Nolan's really good at picking his spots. And this is just a different way of picking his spots, you know? And it really helps the movie.
So you think most of all, overall, the story from a visual standpoint is pretty straightforward? Like, he's not doing much on screen, it's just more storytelling?
Stylistically, yeah. I mean, I have in the past called a lot of Nolan's cinematography frustratingly utilitarian, just because I like that showy stuff. Like, I mean, we talked about Gone Girl recently. I love David Fincher, who's the king of the showman, you know?
Yeah.
It is a pretty, like, he makes really gorgeous movies, but they're gorgeous in a very basic way. And he does want it. He always wants things to look like the real world, kind of, you know. He wants them to look like places that you recognize, and he's very dedicated to making sure that things don't stray from reality too much. Like, a big rule in Nolan's filmmaking is he hates using breakaway walls, where you sort of can move the wall so that you can have extra space for the camera. He doesn't like zoom lenses. He wants the camera to be in the space that the character operates within, because he feels like there's this little thing that the viewer can feel, whether or not they're conscious of it or not, that the camera is within a space as opposed to within a set. That's something I love about him, and it never really shows up as stylistic, but it's this really interesting way of thinking about space, you know, space in film.
Yeah,
and
it's still a choice that has to be made.
Yeah, and I think it at least for somebody like me, I think you can always feel it when something is out of place that way, like when the camera feels too far back, or when, you know, the apartment on Friends is obviously way too huge, and it is because they need to get these cameras in there, you know. And that's the type of thing I always notice. But most of this style in this film visually is just handheld camera work for the most part.
Right. And what about, I mean, this film is a noir or a neo-noir, commonly a genre with a lot of darkness and a lot of shadows, and they are not very present in this movie.
Yeah, exactly. There are, I believe this story takes place over 3 days and two nights, and they really focus on the day, even in that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just a story that happens during the day. The one visual thing that I should mention that happens in this movie is, and I think this is partially budget, partially by design, there are not a lot of wide shots in this movie. And I think it's because they wanted to get across the feeling of further fragmentation, like memories, you know, where with just a close-up of one character, you don't have the edge of the frame, you know, you just have this little piece of information and the rest is sort of fallen away, you know?
Yeah, and that's obviously what Leonard's been dealing with since the attack.
Exactly.
And we see him, you know, having a hard time keeping up with the three people in this movie that aren't him. You know what I mean? Like, we don't need big crowds. We don't need, like, I can't see him inviting a lot more people into his life or having to deal with more big open spaces for him to get lost and confused in.
Like, yeah, exactly.
He's really, you know, you hear it when he talks about how he feels he's doing a better job with his condition than Sammy did, because he, you know, he has a plan, he has a routine, he has a location for everything, and it's about keeping things tight and small and under control. And I think that's you get the sense that Leonard was always kind of a in control, smart, confident kind of person. Mm-hmm. And now he would need to be way more in control and need to be way smarter, and you know, he just whittles his world down. And that's why you know, I think you're right, they're definitely would be a budget element to this, and it was only shot over like 25 or 35 days and not 25 and for like $4.5 million, which is not a ton of money.
It looks way more expensive than a $4.5 million.
I thought that too, but
it's so pretty. Like, it's the best possible execution of like what you can do with pretty basic cinematography and $4.5 million, you know.
Cool.
Yeah, if you put most $4.5 million movies back to back, and this one will look the best.
Yeah,
unquestionably.
That doesn't surprise me. One thing that did surprise me, actually, and again, I had seen this movie a lot, and I kind of knew the twist, and I thought I remembered most things about it. I really forgot that we are privy to the fact that Lenny killed Teddy so early on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, that's one of the first things we see, and it's not like we...
It's the first action we see.
Yeah, it's not even that, it's just, like, the back of a head, or him killing someone, or you see a hand, you know, holding a gun and pulling a trigger, and then, like, a shadow falling over. You really know that that's Teddy, or who you're going to learn is Teddy.
Mm-hmm.
And you're pretty sure that that's Lenny, too. That really threw me off. And, like, that's not the major twist of this movie, but it's still a twist, like, a piece of information that could have been hidden. Yeah. Do you like it right up front the way it is?
Yes. don't change a thing about the first 3 minutes of this movie.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's great, because the whole thing about this movie is that it's a different kind of deception. Like, you know, the idea of most of these movies would be that it would be told in the opposite order of how this movie is being told, which would be chronologically, and the climax of the movie would be Teddy being shot in the head. So I don't think hiding Teddy's identity would really help this movie at all, particularly because, as you pointed out, there are maybe 5 speaking roles in this film, yeah. Or at least in the color portions of this film, outside of the flashbacks. I don't think it would help the movie at all. You know, I think it would obviously be a man, and just because of how short his hair is, and I just don't think you could hide him well. You know,
mm-hmm.
And I don't think hiding him would really do it. It would just be, oh, is he going to kill Teddy or Natalie? Yeah.
Right, and just going back to the way this movie is structured overall, having these two, you know, timelines that are, you know, basically working against each other being told at the same time, that allows us to get the twist where we need it structurally instead mm-hmm. of just where it is chronologically.
Mm-hmm.
Like that reveal of Teddy kind of getting in Leonard's face about... how he's been tricked all this time.
Yeah.
You know, that's pretty early on in the way that this is just a story. But, mm-hmm. you know, when they twist it up like that, it's it places it, you know, right at the middle of the third act. And it definitely has an emotional impact. And mm-hmm. just one, like, I mean, I talked earlier about how the kind of lack of context really lets you empathize with Leonard, but this is one more way at the structure, you know, mixing all these things around and crafting it in just this particular way adds so much to the film overall.
Yeah, exactly. It sort of it makes the climax a more sort of emotional exposition sort of thing, and it's not an action that is the climax of the movie. The climax of the movie is finding out that Leonard will continue to perform various versions of this action over and over again. And it's all about finding out that he is deceiving himself and not physically doing anything. It's all within his mind. And that's the most interesting part of the movie. And that's why it's great that the exposition is the climax of the movie. You know? It's just like another way that it kind of subverts the idea of the revenge thriller. It's not so much about the act of revenge as it is about just having an act to do, you know?
Yeah, well, and we touched on it a bit in The Shining, where some of the creepiest parts aren't about, you know, him swinging an axe. It's, oh, you've been here writing 10,000 pages of all work. Like, it's what you said. It's not the act. It's just, like, the mentality behind it sometimes can be the most terrifying part of it.
And yeah.
I think this movie really nails that. Does your opinion of anyone change over this movie?
I don't think so. I don't follow this movie. I don't think I really care about any of the characters in this movie very much. I think it's just more of an interesting sort of movie to think about. I don't care about the characters in this movie. You know? Like, I care about them in that I care about what happens in the plot. I care about Teddy just because Joey Pants is the greatest. But like, just in general, like, I don't know. I wasn't rooting for anybody, you know?
Right. Yeah. It's,
but I mean, that's kind of how I approach most movies that don't feature Batman, right?
This almost does. Okay. But with Joey Pants, do you think his role in like The Matrix, I guess, would be kind of what most people would know him from when watching this, right?
Probably. And the fact that there's also another cast member from The Matrix in this film would lead them to jump to that, you know?
Right.
Just by putting these two things next to each other. But yeah, I mean, he was one of those character actors in the 90s that was kind of everywhere, you know, for a little bit.
Right, and so I'm just thinking about
his... And The Matrix is very fresh in culture at this time as well.
Oh, extremely. That was, what, May 99, and this is 2000, 2001?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I'm just thinking about...
March 99, The Matrix, by the way.
Okay.
I can't let that error stand.
No, it's
Heaven
okay.
forbid.
My month was off by two letters. Yeah, How dare I?
Yeah. You're fired from the podcast. Podcast over.
So I'm thinking about his role in The Matrix versus his role in this, and they're kind of similar, no?
A little bit, yeah. Yes, I would say they're kind of similar, yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, but then I was also thinking that his character, Cypher in The Matrix, is kind of almost Leonard in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Where he knows the truth. He has the truth available, but he rejects it again for some, you know, what I said earlier is kind of blissful ignorance or deception.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about those two roles. And, you know, in The Matrix, he is the one who kind of sells everyone out to...
Agent Smith and whatnot.
A rock star or something.
I'm sorry, you cut out.
Oh, like he knows The Matrix is fake in The Matrix, and he knows he's basically living a computer simulation, but sells out everyone to be like a rock star or something inside The Matrix. And in this movie, Leonard is kind of inside The Matrix. Like he's living in this constructed world where he's pursuing kind of a meaningless goal because it's built upon a foundation of bullshit that he's kind of imposed on himself.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was weird casting of Joey Pants, but I love him, so I'm glad he's in it.
Yeah,
but.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know that too many people would have made that connection, particularly at the time. I don't think it hurts the movie, even knowing that. Like, I saw both of these, like, Cineplex does their event screen thing, and in March this past year, it was, like, mind-bending movies, and I saw The Matrix and Memento like a week apart from each other, and never thought about that.
Okay.
And so I think a year to 2 years between it. I don't think it hurts the movie, but you just got The Matrix on the brain, and that is an interesting point. I think you are correct, but I certainly don't think it hurts the movie. Yeah.
Okay. And when we meet Teddy, pretty early on, like. Actually, I'll just ask this. Initial reactions, just pretend it's not Joey Pants, just as a character.
I mean, he just seems kind of...
skeezy?
A little skeezy, but also kind of lovable, you know? But I suppose that's the Joey Pants thing. So, I mean, yeah, they cast for the type that they wanted to play the role, and Joey Pants is the skeezy yet lovable type, you know?
Yeah, and I just think, like, so we meet him, we talk to him a bit, and then we see Leonard check his picture fairly early on in the movie, and it says, don't believe his lies, mm-hmm. On the back of Teddy's photo.
Mm-hmm.
We're kind of set up with this negative view of Teddy. Like, you always sympathize with the protagonist just because you have the most exposure to him, and they're usually written as pretty sympathetic, nice people.
Mm-hmm.
And so we take their opinions, you know, kind of as our own, and so we immediately... distrust Teddy. I do, at least. I think most people would.
Mm-hmm.
What are we supposed to make of Teddy by the end? Is he, you know, a bad guy? And then he's kind of the one who is the most honest with Leonard of anybody in this movie, eventually.
Yeah, including Leonard himself.
Yeah, exactly.
I think the thing about this movie is that everybody is sort of left in this... you know, I mean, not Bert, but the main three people are left in this sort of ethical middle ground, you know, where because Teddy has been deceiving Leonard previously to this. You know, he's been kind of, he's been using him, but mm-hmm. he's been using him, and he's been using him for his own gain, you know, but also maybe a gain, or using him in a way that is useful for society. I can't imagine Jimmy being dead hurting Earth in the long run. But yeah, he's certainly not a good person or a bad person, but neither is Leonard and neither is Natalie. Yeah.
Right, but he seems to be giving purpose to Leonard.
Yeah, but I think the final implication of the movie is that Leonard would give himself purpose anyway. He'd find a way to give himself something to do. So I don't think that's the only good thing. But I guess, yeah, he's at least a more controlled murderer that way. But then there's also the idea of, is Leonard Teddy's like half slave, you know?
Yeah, no. I'm certainly not trying to defend those actions.
Yeah.
But when you say Leonard would give himself meaning mm-hmm. or find a way to give his own life meaning, you mean that in a pretty pejorative sense, don't you?
It gives his life meaning to himself, absolutely.
By deceiving himself and killing possibly innocent people in order to make himself feel like he's still working towards something meaningful?
Yes. That is
okay. That kind of meaningful life.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. No, you just made it sound kind of positive, and I was making sure that we are on the same page, that this is a pretty dark ending to this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, it is kind of dark, but I don't know. I find it... it's certainly like, if you look at it in the story of the film, yes, it is dark, but I think the conclusion he comes to is kind of this very human kind of interesting conclusion that doesn't just apply to Leonard, and I think applies to us all in a broader sense, you know?
Can you paraphrase his conclusion then?
Well, the idea, I mean, he sort of talks about this a couple times throughout the movie. There's definitely two. At the very end, I can think of one, and in the beginning with the restaurant scene where he's talking to Natalie about how, you know, when you close your eyes, the world doesn't disappear. What he's based...
Which is a good line.
Yeah, of course. It's a great line. yeah, here's the thing about Christopher Nolan. It ends his movies perfectly 98% of the time. Insomnia...
I think that implies he made 50 movies, by the way.
In my mind, there are a lot of imaginary Christopher Nolan movies that I've made that are really underwhelming, but he nails the ending.
The Adventures of Alex and Christopher by Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, we just sit in a dark room and write comic relief together and never laugh. We'll talk about Nolan endings again. But the idea of that final speech is he's saying that every action that you have that you make has a purpose, whether or not it's remembered by somebody or whether or not it has any effect on anybody but yourself. The idea is that and it ties into memories, because we see this memory of him talking to his wife while she's reading, and he's like, why are you reading this book again? And it's not this extremely pleasant memory, and Nolan talks about this on the commentary track for the movie. It's not a pleasant memory, necessarily. It's just the memory that stuck with him for some reason. Like, maybe he thinks he could have been nicer to her in that moment, and that's why it sort of stuck with him, this sort of, like, pang of regret. And the idea of that is that back when he had a normal memory... he couldn't control what stuck with him. It was just these weird little moments, these moments of possibly nothing, possibly just his wife sitting at a table playing with a fork, you know? And as he develops this condition, he is suddenly 100% in charge of the things he does remember, because as opposed to not being able to control what he remembers, what imprints on him, he has to physically imprint things into himself to make them memorable. And,
to think about memory in an entirely different way.
Exactly.
When you have to be so deliberate about it.
Yeah, and so the whole point is that his actions, anybody's actions, they may or may not be remembered. Like, say, this conversation we're having right now, neither of us might remember it 3 weeks from now.
No one's going to listen to it.
Yeah, exactly. But let's say that you know, somebody did listen to it and somebody does remember it. It's sort of... it has some sort of meaning, even if we don't remember it and we don't control that meaning. The idea of the film is that your actions always have some sort of ripple effect, and it's just what you're going to do with that ripple effect. Leonard doesn't choose to necessarily be ethical, but maybe you should always be good, or at least always be conscious of what you're doing, you know?
Right.
Not everything you do will have meaning, but you never know when what you do will have meaning. So, you know, just think about your actions is basically the idea of the film.
Yeah, and all those, you know, like we see in this movie, Jimmy, as you said, he's probably not a great guy. Like, if he dies, maybe the world will be a better place, but...
Yeah, nobody with that mustache and chain combination is helping the world.
That's part of the UN's charter, I believe.
Absolutely.
No, but you're right, and I agree with you. You know, he's not set up to be a very nice guy. It doesn't seem like his impact on the world is a positive one, but if Leonard just hunts down people with the name John G for the next 50 years until he dies, he's going to kill someone that he shouldn't have killed. Like,
oh yeah, definitely.
That's what I mean. It's I'm agreeing that there's just, it's the butterfly effect, you know, it's so many things where you can't see necessarily all the repercussions of what it is you do, but the best thing to do is be honest and try to live morally, and then that reduces your chances of, you know, having terrible effects on the planet.
Exactly. No, I think that's exactly correct. So it doesn't, yeah, it doesn't necessarily condone what Leonard's doing. It just sort of, it wants to put you in a similar mind state of thinking about what you're doing, and maybe, I don't know, maybe Christopher Nolan wants you to make the same decision Leonard does. Maybe he wants us all to be crazy vigilantes. But,
from some of his other filmmaking, I think that's the answer.
Yeah, exactly. But no, I think it's just sort of the idea of, I think it's weirdly hopeful that life isn't meaningless. I think it's kind of the end point, right, whether or not, because, I mean, there's so much time in your day-to-day life that you will just forget almost immediately. And the idea is that, you know, maybe something that has no repercussion for you ended up meaning a lot to one other person, you know?
Yeah, and someone like Leonard who, you know, has, just because of what he's dealing with neurologically, has a very limited understanding of so much that's going on around him. There are some people who have reduced ability to see what effects they are having on the people in the world around them, whereas everyone with their full faculty can, you know, actually do something.
Yeah, and I think one thing that finally ties all of that stuff together is that the way we see his wife throughout the vast majority of her scenes in this film is these quick flashes of, like I said, those moments that she surely doesn't remember. Like, I already brought up that shot of her playing with a fork on the table. That can't be one of her top five moments in her life. But for whatever reason, it stuck with Leonard. And the idea is that these little moments are what gave Leonard his purpose for living. And they didn't matter to her, but they mattered to somebody else. And that sort of gave her life meaning, and she gave his life meaning, you know?
Yeah, and I think that part of... The exchange of when she's reading that book that you brought up, and they're mm-hmm. kind of back and forth about how she's read it over and over, and him kind of telling that as a story. Mm-hmm. I think that has to be very near the top of my list of Christopher Nolan moments that like ring true emotionally. Like, I think that is some of the best powerful filmmaking I think he's done. Mm-hmm. And it's really not a big moment. You know, it's not... it's not someone's last breath. It's not this big speech. It's not, you know, rallying people into war, but it's this little moment about the little moments, you know, like it's this kind of this small speech about what you remember and the small things you take away and what reminds you of people who mean a ton to you in all these ways. But it's that little stuff is what makes up your idea of them. And I think, like, I like a ton of his movies a lot, but for me, that's one of the things I think of when I think of him doing something really well on just like a very human level.
Yeah. And I 10 minute or so portion of the film is certainly some of my favorite stuff in the movie. Specifically, like, we get these three scenes back to back of first we get Leonard and Natalie in bed, and Leonard is having this monologue about how he doesn't want to wake up and not remember that his wife is gone. And I find that speech really interesting in isolation, because that's sort of something that, like, I remember there was a Michael J. Fox interview about his Parkinson's, like, forever ago. I think this is around the time that Spin City was ending, and I don't even know why I was watching this interview, but where he talks about, you know, sometimes, like, the interviewer asked him if he ever forgets that he has Parkinson's, and he's like, sometimes for 20 seconds when I first wake up, and then pretty immediately it kicks back in, and just everything comes rushing back, and I remember everything. And right. That's something that I apply to Leonard, and I think that's kind of got to be the most depressing part of his mind state, is that maybe sometimes he forgets his wife is dead. And after giving that speech, we cut to the scene of him burning his wife's things, his wife's mementos, that really nice nighttime scene. And then we get the fire and water contrast with the red of the flame. And then we get the dawn. Well, it's shot at dusk, but, you know, it's meant to be dawn of the blue sky. And we get that nice contrast. And then from there, we go to the scene where he hires the prostitute to to basically set up the situation. So if you think about those things in chronologically, you know he's done these things before. And he has decided this is the last time. And then he's talking about it. But
and then we see it happen.
Yeah, exactly. And all of these things, if you think about them in order, sort of because you know the time for him resets three times over this, but it sort of implies that the idea of he's able to condition himself to think about or to remember new things, you know, because he's talking about something in the abstract that he just did, but that he's forgotten about, but it has sort of made an impression on him.
Yeah, you know? Maybe something got, like, you know, deep enough that it actually affects his memory. Yeah.
And also Guy Pearce's performance when he realizes his wife isn't the woman in the bathroom is really amazing. It's like totally wordless, 5 seconds, but it's perfect.
Yeah. How good is he in this movie?
He is faced with an impossible task and he makes the movie work for sure.
Okay.
The fact that he's not bad in this movie is baffling, you know?
In a tough role.
Impossible role. Yeah. And like, you know, I mean, Nolan's next movie similarly put its lead actor in a pretty tough position, like, because Al Pacino is supposed to progressively get more and more tired throughout the movie, and that's a really hard thing to pull off, is to act tired. And he honestly, like, Al Pacino's my favorite actor in the world, doesn't pull it off. And Guy Pearce is kind of faced with this really it's a different challenge, but sort of same sort of impossibility factor, and the movie still works. So he must be amazing in it, you know?
Okay. Yeah. So we talked about how what you do has an effect, even if you don't see it at the time or you never see it. I want to talk about the idea of the cycle, because it was something we talked about in Vertigo. Mm-hmm. Everyone at home drink. We said Vertigo again.
Time is a flat circle. Drink Lone Star beer.
at the listening parties that I'm certain are taking place.
every Friday night they happen.
Right. But I kind of see both of those things we talked about in this movie. Like, I see this movie driving home, you know, what you do has an effect. The people you come in contact with, their lives change because of their time spent with you and what you did with them, mm-hmm. during that time. Mm-hmm. But then we also get the cycle again, and we get this the cyclical nature, and, you know, obviously with Leonard's mind working the way it does, he's kind of always treading water, and things are, he's kind of forced to do things over and over just because that's the only way his brain can keep up with the world happening around him. You know, we have him doing the same things over and over, checking his pockets for pictures, looking at what his car is, going there. Mm-hmm. And then even just in kind of the storytelling, when we have the moments going, you know, I guess backwards, the color moments of this, the color timeline of this, mm-hmm. we often will end a scene at the starting of a different scene, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. That sort of is the thing that is able to ground the audience in this movie, is that we see the connection between scenes. We might see it 5 minutes apart, but were able to sort of be like, get this reminder of, oh, this is where this connects.
Yeah, right. This would be so scattered if we didn't have kind of a few seconds of overlap where, okay, it would now be, we know where we are.
Yeah, the movie would be unbearable if we didn't have that.
Right. And so we kind of have this cycle. And, you know, as I said, he kind of has to do all these things over and over. And we'll go even to Sammy, who, you know, may or may not be, but probably totally is Leonard. He goes through those tests, you know, picking up the objects with Tom Lennon, Dr. Tom Lennon.
Dr. Thomas Lennon.
Dr. Thomas Lennon, sorry. He injects his wife over and over. There's kind of just these juxtaposing ideas of what you do has this effect in straight lines. And, you know, you have this agency you really need to control because of everything that'll come of it. And then we have this idea of the cycle, and, you know, to take it to the end point, is Teddy just lying to Leonard over and over? Is Leonard content to kill someone or kill different people, just strangers, over and over if that gives his life purpose? Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted your take on that kind of contrast of this movie that says, like, these things are so important and maybe nothing's important because it's just, you know, it's just a loop of shit.
Yeah. Well, the idea is,
to put it delicately.
Yeah, the idea is that it's a loop and life is repetitive, but you have to always think that maybe this moment might matter, you know, just because you can't control the moments that do matter. And another element that ties into the whole, the movie is absolutely constructed like a loop. You're definitely right. And we see in the opening, when we get to our first scene, that sort of isn't the credit sequence, where we see Leonard leaving his hotel, and he meets up with Teddy, and they're going to go to Teddy's death, basically. He sort of, you know, gets himself ready. He's wearing the suit. He's got his Polaroid camera. And then he goes to meet Teddy in the lobby. Towards the end of the movie, we're in black and white, and Guy Pearce is, Leonard is wearing his plaid and his puffy vest, and he's getting ready to go meet the person he's been talking to on the phone. He's getting ready to meet them in the lobby. It's right after the take my calls envelope is slipped under his door. And it's shot in the exact same way, just different clothes. Leonard goes out of the hotel room, puts on his Polaroid camera, make sure everything is ready. He's carrying a duffel bag, and then he walks into the lobby of the same hotel. Bert is there.
Bert, yep.
And Teddy is there to meet him. And yeah, it's definitely set up as a loop, and we see the same sort of shot of them pulling up to that compound, just different vehicles, you know, like, yeah. Or a vehicle isn't there, or a vehicle right. has been there already. I can't totally remember in my head, but it's the exact same shot. And yeah, it's absolutely meant to be set up as a loop. And the idea is that, you know, life is a loop, and make sure the moments, or, you know, you're always acting like you have a purpose, basically.
Yeah, I guess my difficulty is kind of negotiating those two ideas.
Okay. Like
that shit just keeps happening over and over. And the idea of what you do does matter, and you can get out of over and over mm-hmm. if you choose to.
I don't know, because I think it does say life is repetitive, which I think life is, but it's just about, I don't know, just there are going to be some moments that stand out from others, and just pretend like every moment will be the standout moment, maybe, you know?
Well, yeah, and...
Or every moment has the possibility to be the standout moment.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. Like, you know, say life gives you 4 different chances at this opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to learn anything from the first 3, and can you make something out of that 4th?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think Leonard, at the end of this movie, has not learned to do something different with that last chance. I think he just kind of invites this cyclical nature into his life. And as long as he kind of feels like in the moment what he's doing has a purpose,
mm-hmm.
You never need to reach that goal, as long as you have a noble goal in mind. And, you know, avenging your raped dead wife at the, you know, at the hands of home invaders is about as noble as it gets, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what do you make of the Sammy storyline? Because it seems kind of tangential until the end, and you find out maybe there was no Sammy. Was there a Sammy?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think. I think the you know, if Nolan was forced to give an answer, you know, a truthful answer as opposed to the dance around answer he would probably try and give in public. I think he would say no, there was no Sammy Jenkins, because I can't imagine the reason for the shot of Leonard as Sammy Jenkins without it, right?
Yeah, and the only thing that I would argue that with is when Teddy's explaining, you know, how that's bullshit. He says Sammy was a con man, a faker. He doesn't say Sammy doesn't exist or you're making up Sammy, so you have something to pin your bullshit behavior on.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have Sammy was this guy who, you know, got in a car accident and was trying to milk insurance money out of it,
mm-hmm.
and he. Leonard just kind of takes whatever details from Sammy's life he feels will make himself seem more sympathetic so he can, I don't know, go death wish for the rest of his life and just kill people.
Yeah. Well, I think then, yeah, I think your point is probably that it's somewhere in between, that there is, there was a Sammy Jenkins that sort of allowed Leonard to sort of come up with these, have these ideas in his head and use some sort of, amalgamation of himself and Sammy to sort of create this situation where his wife is murdered and he's not at fault for it, and he will avenge her death, even though he might kind of be at fault for her death, you know?
Right. Yeah, I think he's...
By being Sammy-ish, you know?
Yeah, and I think, just the way that, you know, their wives died, I think you can see... The one element he was kind of forced to take into his own life, which mm-hmm. is the, you know, suicide by proxy bluff test.
Yeah.
But the one thing that kind of throws me the other way is the, do you remember his Remember Sammy Jenkins tattoo?
Of course. I'm straight up staring at a picture of it right now. It's my desktop background. Anyways.
What's it look like?
A hand with handwriting.
Okay, when would we see writing similar to that in this movie? What's the closest example, if you can remember that?
I don't know.
Okay, well, think of when we see Leonard write anything. Think of the back. Think of all the Polaroids.
Yeah, it doesn't look like that. Yeah.
It's all block caps, right?
Yeah. Except for the first when Teddy makes him write something about Natalie on the back of her photo, which he then scratches out.
Exactly. And I think that's like the kidnapper writing with, or the, you know, kidnapping victim writing with their left hand to throw you off. Like, you get that, right? I think he writes, you know, in kind of cursive, really stylistic. So he knows when he sees this, like, oh, I don't remember what the context of this was, but I know I didn't write this for myself to mean it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't see a font anywhere close to that, except for Don't Trust Your Lies and the Sammy Jenkins tattoo. And to me, that leads me to believe Sammy's mostly a fabrication.
Okay. I mean, there's so many different fonts on his body as well, too, right? Like, I don't think this is the same handwriting that is on the back of that Natalie photo, but...
It's definitely the most similar.
Okay, yeah. No, that's... I don't disagree with that.
Okay. But yeah, and I think this movie... leaves itself open to a lot of interpretation.
Oh, does it?
To the fact, like, have you heard about the... Okay, do you want to talk about the home video release of this?
Okay.
Do you know anything about this?
I don't know, no.
Did you ever rent this movie on DVD or anything? Or see it when you worked at Rogers, the case or anything?
Yeah, it's like Leonard Shelby's case file. Like, is that the one we're talking about?
Yeah. But it's a very atypical DVD case.
Yes.
And the DVD menu, in order to unlock all its features, you kind of have to like answer a bunch of puzzles and a bunch of Sammy Jenkins-like quizzes where you like pick three objects and only if you pick the clock can you turn on subtitles, and like you have to not adjust the audio in order for you to unlock watching all the chapters in chronological order.
Yeah. And the, like, just to watch the movie, you have to find the thing in the test that says watch, and that's the button. It's not play, it's watch.
Yeah. So pretty cryptic and pretty bonkers. But my favorite one is that apparently there's four different audio commentaries with Christopher Nolan that are all, or like, at least at the end, they kind of are different.
Yeah, they're apparently, I only listened to one of them, but apparently they're slightly different in the last 20 minutes. And you can see, like, when I was watching it on the DVD, yeah, I have that DVD, by the way. But then, like, the you can see on the DVD, it switches to, like, when you get to the hour and 30 minute mark of the movie, it just switches to a whole nother track on the DVD. And I think it randomly selects one of these four, and three of them are slightly different versions of the last 20 minutes. And the last one is apparently just noise, basically.
Okay. And yeah, my understanding is that it's one of them is him kind of saying Teddy's totally lying. One of them saying Teddy's kind of telling the truth. One of them saying Teddy's completely telling the truth, mm-hmm. or something. You know, it's just the audio. It's obviously the film's intact, but it's basically the director's interpretation or explanation of what he's done very slightly, which I love.
Yeah, of course. And I mean, this is the only movie, as far as I know, that Nolan has done a commentary track on. So he doesn't like doing these things. So it makes sense that if he's doing one for this movie, that he would purposely fuck with you, basically.
Yeah, he and Jonathan Nolan, his brother, are pretty hands-on with some of the like marketing and like production of this movie, eh?
Oh yeah, very much. Jonah Nolan designed the website, more or less, and that continues still. Christopher Nolan's very hands-on in the ad campaigns for his movies still.
In what sense?
Of the whole, like, he knows, or he's very controlling over what they show and what they don't show. Because, you know, if you look at a trailer for a Christopher Nolan movie up next to a trailer for, you know, an average movie, there's just so much less given away in a Christopher Nolan movie. Like, you think back to the trailers for pretty much any movie. The Batman ones are more straightforward, but Inception, it was you had no real idea what the structure of the movie was really going to be like. It was just pretty shot, Paris folding in on itself, you know, buildings falling apart, Cobb spinning atop. You didn't know what any of those things meant, but you knew you were amped up to see that movie. You know?
Right.
And that's kind of how he structures his movies and, his trailers. And he's seems to always still be fairly hands-on with these things about what to give away, when to give it away, and what to absolutely never give away, you know, until people see the movie.
Yeah, I saw that he edited the film, like, these trailers himself.
Oh, really?
I think you're right. I think in the most recent part of career, it seems like he is adamant about not showing too much in trailers. Mm-hmm. But I don't think he's, you know, editing these trailers anymore.
No, no, God, no.
But I think it's important to him to kind of leave that element of mystery.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is a much different part of his career, too. Like,
his
car is in this movie, and it's just this beat-up piece of shit white Honda Civic. He mentions it in the commentary track. It's really funny. It's, like, just next to Leonard's car at one point. He's like, that's my car next to Leonard's. It's still running.
I read that. It made me so happy.
It was pretty funny.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
They're showing a lot for Interstellar, though. I'm kind of surprised.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. More I don't... It doesn't feel like a lot to me. But that's also a movie that... I mean, he doesn't have the Batman selling point, so they kind of have to show more of the flashy stuff because it's not a franchise, you know? It's harder to sell. They're selling it off his name alone. Let's talk about the color blue, because this movie is very blue.
Sure.
I assume you noticed it, right?
I did notice it till I read about it.
Oh, really? I think it's like borderline oppressive. Like they go as far as you can with the color blue in this movie without pissing me off.
Why is that?
Why do they use the color blue, or why does it not piss me off?
Why do they use the color blue?
Well,
and is it present in the color scenes a lot?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Go ahead.
And
then.
Even
because I read something, but I want to hear your bit on it.
Okay. And even knowing like the black and white scenes, we never see an environment in black and white that we haven't seen in color or don't see in color. And even his hotel room is, aside from the flashbacks, you know, his hotel room is even, the walls are all blue. And his shirt all throughout the movie is blue.
It's actually blue, not just tinted blue.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
His old truck, or what does he, is it implied that he used to use that truck that he's dumping the bullets in?
End? I never got an explanation about why, but in that scene you were describing earlier where they go to the abandoned building and you kind of get that shot again, but for the first time.
Yeah.
Yes, that's his
I'm picking some of the least.
It dumps bullets all over the chair.
I'm picking some of the least important blue parts, but most importantly, his shirt is blue, and he's kind of encased in the color blue. And Christopher Nolan loves Terrence Malick, loves Michael Mann, and with Malick always sort of uses that fire and water contrast, and Nolan likes to use it when he can. Like I mentioned earlier in this movie, when he's burning his wife's mementos, and as the fire goes away, we're sort of left with this dawn blue, like this sort of magic houry blue, yeah. And it's this really nice contrast, and that's really present in The Dark Knight. Like it's all the color scheme of Dark Knight is all fire and water for the Joker and Batman. But there's a lot of that, and Michael Mann often uses blue, most specifically in Heat, to symbolize loneliness. I mean, it's not like this is a Michael Mann thing, but I think that's what most strongly influenced Nolan. And so I think he's using the color blue to symbolize loneliness, and that's why literally, like, for most of this movie, Guy Pearce is literally covered in the color blue because he's so lonely. He's totally by himself, and it's meant to be loneliness. And when we see his wife's death, the scene where we see the most action of that scene, as opposed to like the quick flashes in the editing, there's this spilling of this case of blue bath salts, and it's a glass thing, and it breaks, and blue bath salts go everywhere. Yep. And it's like, as Leonard's wife dies, this loneliness is introduced into his life. And
as she bleeds out, blue bleeds into his life.
Exactly. And yeah. I didn't look too hard for it in the color flashbacks of the shots of her, but I suspect there is zero blue in those shots, you know? And the idea is that, Leonard is extremely lonely. There's even a scene where Teddy and Leonard are talking in his car outside of Natalie's house, and there's just this blue dumpster behind the car, or next to the car, yeah. That's behind Leonard, but not behind Teddy. And it's just sort of showing that Leonard is a very lonely person. Because he's just in his own head all the time, and he doesn't really know anybody, you know? It's just him. Yeah. And I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, so what I read about the blue is that...
And Eiffel 65 closes the movie.
Starting a long-time collaboration between Christopher Nolan and Eiffel 65.
Exactly.
No, but what I read about the blue was that because this movie splits between black and white and color, as mm-hmm. we discussed, and should be quite obvious, they have to put it on color stock, like the actual film has to be color stock. Mm-hmm. There's a difference between color and black and white. And that when you do, like when they first started shooting this black and white stuff, they really liked the look of it. And who was cinematography on this?
It's Wally Pfister.
Oh, yeah. Your boy. I forget. So Wally Pfister was very, very happy with the dailies he was looking at, and the color looked really good. He said, like, the deep blacks were there. We really, really liked it. And then in order to have black and white and color on the same film stock, you have to either go with kind of a red tint or a blue tint to your black and white stuff. Mm-hmm. And so this doesn't explain the color stuff, why they put so much blue in. Like, that's, I think, as you've explained, a deliberate choice for thematic reasons.
Yeah, yeah.
But the reason it's there is in the black and white is they had to choose between blue or red, and they just thought blue would be better.
Yeah.
And I think, as you said, like, if you have all this blue in the one half of the movie, if you have to choose between blue and red,
go with blue.
Yeah, and so many of the black and white moments are Leonard just alone, right? So mm-hmm. it makes sense to go that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so where does this, we kind of, you kind of brought it up a few ways. Where does this fit in on the Nolan spectrum? Like, what kind of stuff do we see in this that we continue to see in a lot of Nolan stuff? Is there anything that kind of falls by the wayside that he gets rid of, or kind of only really applies here? Or kind of as an auteur, how is this not or is Nolan-esque?
It is very Nolan-esque in that, I mean, the one thing I think pretty much all of Nolan's movies do is that they sort of give you like this really satisfying look at a pretty like a genre that's not hard to grasp at all. Like the average person is just can be very entertained by this movie without having to think about it all that much.
A revenge movie or a superhero movie to go exactly. later in his career. Okay,
exactly. Yeah. Like the weirdest it gets is a magician competition, you know? But or the least genre-esque, but even then it's still just a competition movie. But and to sort of make these pretty simple narratives and sort of I don't know, for lack of a better term, jazz them up in a way that leaves you with these questions, but never with sometimes a lot of questions like this movie, but never in a way that's frustrating. And you always get some sort of ending to the actual narrative of the film, but the thematic elements of the movie leave you with a lot to think about. And I think Memento really fits into that. And I think there is sort of the spectrum of Nolan movies that I think you can look at from probably like Memento, and then you get The Prestige, and then you get Inception right in the middle, and then you get his Batman movies in some order from there. And Inception being the meeting in the middle sort of portion of his career, where this sort of weird narrative meets with this big blockbuster sort of idea. And Inception is like Memento, like told a story in kind of an odd way, but never in a way that was hard to follow, I don't think. I think that's kind of the great thing about Inception, and gives you this really, really satisfying ending that also leaves you with stuff to think about. And I think that's what Nolan's movies always do. The other thing that is kept within this movie is the Terrence Malick cut-ins. Pretty much every one of his movies has those, where like the shots of his wife, basically these sort of context-free flashes, you know. Those are there. I don't know. I think like pretty much the blueprint for his whole career is in this movie. You know, there's not a lot that really totally goes away. You know, like the blue in this movie is flashier than the colors in pretty much any of his other movies. You know, there are some stylistic choices, like first character styling, that I would call poor. Like they just make people look shitty. You know, like Guy Pearce looks like an idiot with his hair and his suit.
Jimmy's suit, that still photo of him with no shirt on, like a lot of goofy looking Guy Pearce in this.
Yeah, I mean, I like the whole the baggy suit thing throughout the movie, and then you find out that it's just because Jimmy's a bigger person. I think that's a funny little joke that's never really addressed. But yeah, it's just sort of, there's just some weird things that kind of jump out in this movie as not looking, I don't know, totally, I don't know, appropriate, I suppose. But I don't know, just such nitpicky things. Like the fact that I think he was 28 when he made this movie. Like, I'm 28. I can't even fathom coming up with this sort of shit, you know?
Yeah. It,
I still can't understand the movie, you know?
To me, what's really interesting is to kind of be able to pick out enough things like that from a movie released in 2000, so let's say shot in 99 probably, for $4.5 million, and just drawing complete parallels to a superhero. You know, this is a very small, pretty psychological neo-noir, I guess, is the most specific you can get. At $4.5 million with like 5 characters and 7 locations.
Yeah, yeah.
Inception, let's see, a lot of big actors, a ton of money, like $200 million, different planes of reality. And then, you know, a superhero trilogy, and then we have Interstellar coming up, which is obviously going to be outer space and all these things. And there's just these clear lines you can draw, like thematically and visually, of what he continues to do, no matter what the subject matter is, what the plot, characters, budget. And I think that just speaks to someone who knows what they want to do, no matter what tools are in their hand.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, we touched on this a bit with when we were talking about the ending of Memento. Like I said, I think Nolan's best skill is he ends his movies very well. And it was something I kind of wanted to bring up in Vertigo when you said you have a problem with Hitchcock endings. I think Nolan ends his movies just like Hitchcock does. It's just sort of the modern style makes it like it's a style you know, it's existing in a filmmaking environment that we're more used to than when we flash back to 1958 and watch Vertigo. You know, we didn't know how films were made then. He takes his the way he ends his movies is he makes everything build to the final scene, and that's where you get sort of this point. And the point is meant to tie up the narrative and also leave you with something to think about, but also do it in this very entertaining way. Always cuts to black. The one ending he has that's not good, Insomnia, it fades to black. Number one lesson for all filmmakers, cut your movie to black. But the idea is that he makes his final point, and then the movie's over. And like we talked about with Vertigo, with James Stewart looking over the ledge, that's the end point of the movie, is that his problem has gone away and been replaced by this totally new problem. Memento, it's us figuring out that Leonard is a person that's just going to keep going round and round. He's talking about his actions do have meaning. Our actions do have meaning. He might be making some questionable choices, and then we're out. You know, we're out of the movie. And all of Nolan's other movies build with that and leave you with something really interesting to think about, but in this really so well executed way, you know. Like and the music always builds to this cut to black, and then the fucking top, is it spinning or not? I don't know. People are awing, and but everybody's talking about it, and they feel something, and they don't necessarily know what it is. But I think the real key to Nolan's success with the average film goer is that his movies end in such a satisfying way and leave you totally confused for about 5 minutes. But by that 5 minute mark, you have an idea of what the movie was about. And there's just this weird thing that he is able to do where he makes these really engaging, entertaining movies that frustrate you for like 5 minutes and 5 minutes only after the credits start rolling. And like pardon?
And then you can enjoy them.
Yeah. And then you're just like, holy shit, that movie was amazing. And yeah, I don't know. I hope Interstellar doesn't let me down. I don't know. I'm very concerned about sentimentalism getting a bit too far into space drama, but so it goes.
Fair. Well, if I can't think of a better hook for our listeners to stay tuned for.
Yeah.
You being heartbroken by the end of Interstellar.
Well, I mean, I think we've had this conversation every movie since The Dark Knight. Like, he's got to make a bad movie sometime. I know you and I disagree a bit about The Dark Knight Rises, but I certainly still hasn't made a bad movie.
Anderson can do it, why can't Christopher Nolan?
Well, that's the thing. Like, as directors approach middle age is when they tend to start sucking, you know, like, or not start sucking, but start to either try things that aren't in the style that we love them for. And I mean, that's absolutely their right. But, you know, I mean, Martin Scorsese had a pretty hardcore down period. Everybody kind of agrees on that. And depending on where you stand on Scorsese, he might still be in that period. And I mean, it kind of happens for everybody. And now I'm kind of at the point where with all of my favorite filmmakers, I'm always a little scared when they put out a new movie, because what if this is the one that I don't like? You know, what if I don't like Inherent Vice?
Yeah. Julian Bell's in it. You'll be okay.
Oh, okay. I didn't know. But thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next week.
If you want to hear Alex cry, check back in a few weeks when Interstellar comes out and inevitably blows.
Next week, in 2 weeks from now, me crying for an hour. And yeah, I don't know what we'll be talking about after that. But yeah, thank you for listening to this, and check back next week.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening!